Hey everyone, welcome back to Wild and Unprotected, our podcast focused on limelight. Okay, see how this works. I'm nervous because there's two of you. One sec. Okay.
This is how this is gonna go.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid to laugh.
Hey everyone, welcome back to.
I know a podcast, and I know that this is actually gonna go into it.
This is going in the podcast for sure. Classic.
We actually were joking about setting up an OnlyFins account.
Here's to us all swimming through the shit and making more sense of it.
Wild and unprotected. Planet Earth, we can't neglect it. Nature's sexy. We need this place, so please respect it.
Hey everyone, welcome back to Wild and Unprotected. On this week's episode, we're diving into the International Fund for Animal Welfare with Misty Niemeyer.
Hi, I'm so excited to be here.
Hey, Misty, glad to have you on the show. And this show is particularly special because we have a second guest as well. We have Stacey Hedman, the Director of Communications for IFAW.
Hello, everyone.
We're so glad to have you guys here today.
Thank you for joining us. We're super excited to really dive into what IFAW is and what you do. I know we had a quick introductory before we hit record, but for the audience out there, let's just go ahead and get started. Misty, can you kind of dive into, who you are, what you do, and then we can kind of move into your career as of late.
Sure. So I guess, do you want me to start from the way back or just what I do right now?
Let's go way back.
Okay. Sure. So, I grew up in San Diego, so I grew up on the coast. So I was lucky enough to grow up tide pooling with my dad in San Diego. And I saw a gray whale when I was a young girl. So I've always had that connection to the ocean and to the marine environment. And I ended up in school at Humboldt State University up on the coast of California. And where I was lucky enough to intern with very hands-on projects where I helped capture harbor seals to study their populations and count their populations to see if they were declining and do aerial surveys to count gray whales and do harbor seal counts and do very hands-on projects learning about marine mammals and how to study them and how to conserve their populations. And from there, I kind of bounced around, starting to do a lot of conservation work, including going out to Hawaii to study the endangered Hawaiian monk seal. And that brought me out to the East Coast, out to here to study the North Atlantic right whale. And I kind of migrated up the coast with the right whale and ended up on Cape Cod doing aerial surveys initially for studying North Atlantic right whale, where I started actually volunteering for what at the time was the Cape Cod Stranding Network. And then later on, started to work for them as the necropsy coordinator as they merged with what is now IFAW's Marine Mammal Rescue and Research Team. And I now serve as their training coordinator. But when I was a little kid, I also used to, I think my parents appreciated it, but they may not have, but I used to pick up pretty much every stray animal that came by, kittens, birds, anything, bunnies, anything. So I've kind of always had that animal rescue sort of thing in me, I guess, or it's always been a part of me, always been something I've been interested in. And so my parents weren't all that surprised when this ended up being my career path. And this, I can't really imagine myself doing anything else, to be honest. This job really kind of suits me, the people I work with. Everything about this job is just really kind of is who I am and really kind of I just can't imagine doing anything else. But I now serve as the team's stranding coordinator, and we are the organization that is permitted to respond to stranded marine mammals. So that means any live or dead dolphin, whale, or seal, or and porpoise, and we respond to all dead animals that wash up on our shores, and also try to rescue any live animals that strand in this area. And that's a very short snippet of what we do. So our team also tries to do all the work that we try to do. We try to do it through a scientific mindset to try to improve the animal welfare and the stranding science that we do. But we also do a significant amount of training and use that work to share that knowledge with our national and our international partners as well. And then we try to use that work to also help move forward conservation efforts for the species that we work with as well.
Yeah, it seems like it's a fairly large organization, and communications is very important. And I think that's kind of a perfect segue into introducing Stacy and your kind of path to where you've gotten to as director of communications for the organization.
Yeah, it is a large organization. We are, I think, about 54 years old and covering the entire world. So all the way from koalas to elephants to rhinos and everything in between. So it's an incredible place to be. And how I came to this work was entirely through a corporate background. So working for agencies and marketing other daily necessities that we all think we need, like cell phones and such. So I really kind of came in when an organization like IFAW was evaluating whether it needed social media. So I kind of brought that agency background and social media background 7 or 8 years ago to IFAW. But now that I'm in the nonprofit space, I wouldn't want to be anywhere else. I think it's incredible to love what you do, as Misty said, and to come home at the end of the day or the end of the week and know that you are doing something, even if you're just communicating and marketing on it, but that it's towards a meaningful goal. So thanks for having us.
Yeah, we're excited to have you guys. And to kind of expand upon that, you know, working in the nonprofit world, you know, passion, passion, passion. If you're doing what you're passionate about, you don't really work a day in your life. So, and that makes creating shows like this, working on marketing materials, you know, while you might not be hands-on with those animals, it still feels incredibly impactful. So that's amazing. And we're happy to have you both.
Don't let Stacy fool you. We drag her out in the field.
Yeah, are the best days. Those are the best days. So it is an incredible global hotspot for this activity. So unfortunately, that means we get to go out there quite a lot. And there's an incredible amount of balance with cameras and microphones and getting quotes and telling this story and getting it to media. But it happens spontaneously all the time. So there's never really much warning.
Yeah. And those people in media, they're a pain in the butt to work with.
We're very lucky. We're very lucky.
So, Stacy, do you feel like do you feel like when you took on this director of communications position that IFAW would be in a different place if you didn't bring that background to the company?
Yeah, I mean, I did start on the social media side, proving that IFAW needed social media. So you can imagine where that's gone. TikTok is our prized possession. I think we're absolutely above all else when it comes to conservation organizations on TikTok. Definitely check it out, IFAW Global. It is hilarious and grabs all the trends.
It is pretty impressive. Oh, yeah. I do have to say, it's pretty
the
impressive.
The team is incredible. And when there's a trend popping, it's popping for animals on our channel. So. It's a huge difference, and it's not to my credit at all. It's to the changing world and having to stay abreast of all the different changes. But any day of the week, when I get to kind of kick off my heels and pull on waders, because Misty has provided me with waders, and go out in the field, it becomes a whole different day with another cool. Maybe you don't know when the day is going to end, but it is really great to be part of the team out there.
Wow. Yeah, awesome. That's incredible. I think you hit the nail on the head right there, talking about the ever-changing times and, you know, trying to be updated and stay along with technology to make sure that, you know, you're staying in front of all the noise. I was unaware of your pop in TikTok, but I'm definitely going to have to go check it out now.
Please do.
So Misty, to kind of dive back in to your career and the direction that you were going, you were saying that Cape Cod is a hotspot for what you do. So can you explain a little bit more about your career as you kind of moved forward through that and the day-to-day of what you have now?
Sure. Well, two kind of things to unpack there. One, I actually was brought to Cape Cod basically for the work that I did specifically with right whales. So North Atlantic right whales are a critically endangered species. So there's fewer than or about 350 North Atlantic right whales left in the world, and they are impacted by us as humans. So they're entangled in fishing gear and they're hit by vessels. And they are unlike other species, they did not bounce back like many other species after they were protected because they are so their worlds kind of overlap with the human world so much, and they just weren't able to kind of recover like other many other whale species did. And so many groups like IFA have been trying to work to conserve them and research them and try to help protect them, but they're just not, unfortunately, bouncing back. And so what ends up happening, so I was flying aerial surveys and doing vessel-based surveys to research their population. And that's what brought me to Cape Cod, working with NOAA Fisheries, doing that work. And that's how I started volunteering with the Stranding Network, both doing necropsies and outreach and education, but also landed myself at a few whale necropsies and ended up volunteering with the Stranding Network. And that's how I got connected with the team here and then ended up starting as their necropsy coordinator. And that's how I kind of got my connection with the team. That has been a really big part of our team's work and my career's work. So I went from studying right whales in the air and by sea to studying them on the beach. So learning about what's killing them, basically, which is kind of a sad part, aspect of what we do, but is a very important part of the work that we do. All of the necropsy or animal autopsy work that we do is incredibly important part of the work that our team does, because it can inform both us, but also managers and legislators or people who make laws about what it can do. And also try to give us information about then what can we do to come up with solutions for how to then protect them. And so it's really pivotal work, but it also can be kind of hard on our team because you're seeing these incredible animals that a lot of people don't think of them as charismatic like humpbacks, but I personally think they're amazing and they're very cool. I think they have charm. But other people think they're kind of goofy looking or kind of weird. And they don't have some of the same charismatic features that, you know, humpbacks are known for. But I don't know. I think they have personality. I think they need a Pixar film. You know, the work that we do is really important to help inform that.
That wink got me.
Sorry, made me lose my train of thought here. I don't even know where I was going with that. Help me get me back on track here.
We're going through the necropsies.
You're focusing on the whales and the right whale specifically.
Totally lost my train. So it's valuable work. That's a really important aspect of what we do. So while it's tough work to do, and I mentioned this, I think, before when we were talking previously, it also takes a village. So while I was the necropsy coordinator and now the training coordinator, and I do a lot of the logistics coordination for it, these necropsies can take up to, you know, anywhere from sometimes we only have a small team available to do it, or but it can be up to 20 or 30 people on a beach to do these necropsy events to do. So it can be kind of incredible work that we're doing. It's very valuable and important work. So that's one side of the things that we do. We do get a high number of strandings here, whale strandings here on the Cape, compared to other places. But then what we're very well known, our team is very well known for, is our dolphin stranding. So we get about a quarter of the live cetaceans or small cetaceans. So that's mostly our dolphins, that strand here on the Cape in the U.S. So a quarter of the live dolphins that strand in the U.S. strand right here on Cape Cod. I do my little my little arm, for Cape Cod. We are a hotspot in the world for dolphin strandings. We get the most frequent strandings of anywhere in the world. And that's something that a lot of people don't know. So there's places in New Zealand and in Australia that are also well, and in Florida that are well known for, dolphin strandings, are what we call mass strandings of dolphins. So anytime you have a group of dolphins that strand together, but here on the Cape, we are the only place that gets these frequent, consistent, strandings of dolphin strandings of anywhere in the world. So, and it averages out sometimes to about 70 dolphins a year. So, it's hopping wow. around here. So what that means is that our team has gotten really good at it because we have to do it all the time. And so we've gotten very innovative with our equipment, with our techniques. We have a very skilled team. That has been able to basically push forward and figure out how to rescue these animals, how to get good at treating them, how to get good at diagnosing them. And we have been able to kind of get it down to, you can call it either an art or a science or some combination of both, to basically rescue as many dolphins as we can. So we have state-of-the-art equipment that we have basically, a lot of it we have designed or made for specifically for this work, and been able to kind of, we basically treat these animals are basically going through kind of the equivalent to a car accident. So it's a kind of a traumatic event for them. So we've created basically like a dolphin ambulance. It's a bit bigger because it's created for about 6 dolphins, but we fit up to about 9. We call it our mobile dolphin rescue clinic, or for short, we call it Moby, because it's a giant white truck about the size of a motorhome. And it transports our dolphins from, if I use my arm again, I don't know if you can see it very well, but most of our dolphins strand inside Cape Cod because it's basically a giant dolphin trap. It's kind of why we have this stranding phenomenon here, and we want to get them out of that dolphin trap. So we extract them from whatever area they might be stranding in. And a lot of times, a lot of people think of, I think, you know, dolphin rescue is maybe kind of like when you're in Florida, it's like sunny, beautiful day, working with dolphins in the water. Usually it's freezing, it's muddy, we're stuck in the mud, it's at night, it's kind of miserable. So it's none of, I think, what people picture it to be. But we extract them from the situation that they're in. We try to get them into Moby, into our dolphin ambulance. We try to assess them, provide them with supportive care. We give them fluids. We give them medications. We run bloods. We have a mini clinic inside of Moby. So we can do all of this while we're basically transporting them up to one of our release sites. And hopefully we have a vet staff that is also with us in the field, is able to help our biologist with the health assessor, conduct the health assessment. And then hopefully by the time we're at the release site, we're able to determine if the animals are able to be released. And if we have animals that we're concerned about, we might affix the temporary satellite tag so we can learn more information about that animal once it's released. And from these tags and from the data that we've collected, been able to learn quite a bit about these animals and about if they're able to survive, and been able to keep pushing that forward with each and every release. So as I mentioned, this is, so these dolphins are, they're mammals like us, so they breathe air. So they are able to be out of the water for a period of time, but they are dolphins. They're not adapted to being on land. So they can suffer. So this is a traumatic event. They can suffer from shock. They can suffer from trauma from these events. So we do try to be very timely about it. We don't want to push them back in the water because this, as I mentioned, Cape Cod, it's a giant dolphin trap. It's very tidally dependent. So at high tide, they can have 10 to 12 feet of water to swim in. Perfect, great, wonderful. They could have followed food in, things like that. 6 hours later, there's no water. It's gone. And if we leave them in that area.
And you
area,
don't want to release them back into the trap, right?
Exactly.
Which is why you move the release point.
Exactly. Or there could be something wrong with them. They could have some sort of injury or something like that. So in our area and also other areas, and most areas of the U.S. and in a lot of areas of the world, there's either an established stranding network or there are many developing stranding networks where there, so there may be experts in that area. Being able to let those experts get on site, assess the animal, and be able to do the proper get that animal what treatment they need or do what's best for that animal in that area, allows for the best animal welfare and the best care for that animal versus pushing the animal back in the water where they may strand somewhere else that may be more difficult to get to, or those repeat stranding events may be detrimental to that animal. And also it's handling these animals can also be, you know, how you handle them can potentially, you know, cause them harm if not handled properly.
It really makes us cringe when we see some of, you know, speaking of TikTok, but when we see some of these videos of heroes that are pulling animals back into the water, and it's really sometimes just a matter of calling. There's usually, like Misty said, there's usually a hotline or a local team that can really help. And it's there are a few important things to consider, and the experts are really the ones that can be there to do that.
Yeah, and I think we get a lot of questions a lot about, you know, people often want to pet the dolphins or they want to handle the animals. And I often think about it when we're doing this is we must be like aliens invading these animals and sticking all these probes in them. It must be, you know, feel very awkward. We are not, you know, it's not comforting to them. They're not pets. They're not our pets, and they're wildlife. And we must be, this is very stressful sort of encounter for them. So we always try to keep that in mind. We try to keep our voices low. We try to keep it to the work that we're trying to do with the animals. And we try to create as much of a calm environment as we can to try to lower the stress levels for these animals while we're working with them, to try to keep them as calm as possible and keep their stress levels as low as we can. But we know it's still a very stressful situation for them while we're doing this rescue work. So we don't expect that they know that what we're doing for them is good for them. Sometimes they can be calm, but other times they are not calm. And we recognize that our presence can be in our touch while we're handling them can be very stressful to them.
It's pretty incredible to come into this and it's so silent. Everyone's so quiet. It's really awesome. Sorry.
You brought up a really good point about how, you know, it must be incredibly foreign, or we seem like aliens to dolphins. I couldn't imagine being a dolphin and not seeing anything that was bipedal at first. And you're like, what the hell is it doing? It has, what are those hands? What are those? I couldn't imagine how that would feel. You know, from that perspective, seeing something so foreign, not understanding it, and out of a sudden it's sticking a thermometer up its butt.
I can only imagine. I mean, we put ECGs on them just like you would in a human hospital or a human ambulance, and we draw blood, we put IV fluids in them, we're giving them medications. So we're literally poking and prodding them. And we do thermometers as well on occasion. And so I can only imagine what this must be like to them. And I think while we want to feel like the animals are appreciative of it, I think they just want to get the heck out. And they just want us to leave them alone. And we know with seals, for sure, they are trying to bite us and they are trying to wiggle away from us. We know that for sure. With dolphins, they don't have that ability. So they can't really as easily. So it's not as noticeable, but I can only imagine that is likely what they are, you know, thinking, that they just really want to get away from us. So we do our best to try to keep things calm and try to remember that while we know we are trying to do the best thing for them, it is what we are working with wildlife, and we always try to keep that in mind. And we try to be as quick as we can. We try to keep them as calm as we can and try to, so that we can release them and back to the wild, as quickly as we can.
So Misty, you brought up, you know, Cape Cod being the hotspot for dolphin strandings. Is there a second place or a third place location on the planet that also experiences something similar?
So it's similar but different. So Australia and New Zealand both have locations, but they get And Florida has some occasion for this as well, but they will get larger, less frequent straining events. But not the same frequency that we do. So we get sometimes smaller. I'm a little afraid to say it because I'm highly superstitious.
The whole team is crazy superstitious.
So, do you guys have like lucky flippers that you take out?
No. But we just, we don't talk about straining. It's like, we just don't talk about it. We don't say certain words. Like we just don't talk about
Bruno.
Yeah, exactly. So we're just
Mickey
a little,
Mouse don't
we're
sue
a little
us.
Crazy. We're a little crazy about it. And I'm a little bit the worst, about it, but, so they tend to get, you know, less frequent, but bigger events. But we are one of the unique places that gets more consistent in one place over and over again. And we used to have a more consistent season of in the winter season. So kind of December through March or April. And we do still see that seasonality to some extent. But over the last few years, it's really, and we don't know if this is due to climate change or kind of what it's due to, but we really now see strandings more year round. So we see strandings in the spring, we see them in the summer, we see them in the fall. So we don't really get the off season that we used to get, which, you know, yeah, that is kind of what it is. We've definitely seen a straining trend of strandings increasing as well. And that seasonality kind of shifting a little bit as well.
Oh, because strandings happen so frequently for us and maybe less frequently in other places, it's been really impressive for me in working with the team on how much we're called internationally to even just guide over the phone, to offer some advice when something really tragic is happening around the world, and to be called on as experts because we really do have that expertise and that frequency, the skill set that's really coming from that repetition. There are entire rescue teams that come over to train with us, or we go to them to help train them. And the incredible amount of international publications that our team has been in. It's really impressive, especially being a Cape Codder, to kind of be able to say this little Cape Cod, team. It's not a small team, but it is a small team, that we are making such an impact around the world, and called on as experts.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It seems like you guys are kind of the backbone of the stranding education industry.
Well, we're one of there, for sure. I think that consistency that Stacey's talking about of basically we get to practice all the time, that definitely has led us to be able to share a lot of that knowledge, with a lot of our colleagues, and help. But we get to collaborate and share and go back and forth with a lot of our stranding colleagues, all over the world and throughout, Europe and South America and Australia and New Zealand. And so, we're really lucky to do that. So yeah, as Stacey alluded to, we do trainings internationally, or nationally and internationally. Our team will go out and, we've done trainings, throughout the world. And as well as we'll bring colleagues, to come work with us so they can get some more hands-on training, as well. Although it's unpredictable, but that's a great way for people to get some hands-on training. But then we'll also get called in for specific events as well. So when something, a more long-term event is happening, our team will get called in for specific events and try to go out and help on in those occasions when that can line up as well. It's a little harder because trainings are, as we mentioned, a very unpredictable thing. We get called out a lot specifically for those whale necropsies as well, because our team, it never seems like it's big enough. It does seem like it's a big team for straining work, but when you have 45 dolphins on the beach, or when you have a adult right whale or an adult humpback, it's never enough people. But our team will get called out to help with whale necropsies quite a bit as well, or their straining network agencies, if they have mass straining events or live cetacean events, will get called out, or a seal that ends up in a very poor, a bad area, things like that. Our team will get called in to go help out, both in the U.S. and outside of the U.S.
Wow, that's incredible that, you know, you have such a big organization that reaches both nationally and internationally. I think that's one thing that we spoke about previously before we hit record. But I want to backtrack a little bit. Misty and Stacey, when when was the last field mission that you two were able to be on together?
Oh,
if any.
I don't think we've traveled together, actually, have we?
Well, here, yes. Gosh, Misty. Well, I'm in Brussels right now, so it's hard for us sometimes, given my travel lately, but gosh.
I thought you meant abroad. I'm like, we haven't traveled abroad together, but we've done plenty of...
Wink. I'll do the Stacey wink.
Yes. Yeah. I missed the wink before. But yeah, we've been plenty of dolphin strandings together.
I think our last was probably when we had a visitor and we were out in... The release was Herring Cove, the stranding of the Bellfleet. It's about 5 or 6 dolphins, and it was maybe just last summer.
Yes, I believe so. I'm trying to remember. It was this is going to come across wrong, I'm sure, but it was like your typical dolphin response. So we've gotten so good that it was when we have 5 or 6 dolphins, it's like, it's kind of standard for us these days.
Oh, we got this. It's just 5 or 6 dolphins. We got this. Don't worry. We got the arm. We're good.
But it was a wonderful one. It ended really well. It was like we released all of them. It was a beautiful day. Like the release was, I remember the release. It was a really lovely release.
Yeah.
So that I do remember.
I will say there.
That's a good thing though, when it gets to that point.
Yeah, true. There was one recent example. I think it was November, and I was at the Global Convention for Endangered Species. It's called CITES, and it's in Panama. And 5 pilot whales stranded. Is that correct, Misty?
Oh, yeah.
They stranded on a Sunday, because like Misty pointed out, it's always on a holiday or a weekend or a really cold event. But for me, you know, I mentioned earlier, we have an incredible, person who works with us on Cape Cod when I can't be there. And, the photos and videos and audio recordings that she was able to capture, feed to me in Panama and for me to reach out to Boston, New York, DC media and have that all be the kind of biggest story. I think it was in People magazine the next day. To have that be an incredible big story, it takes that full team on Misty's side and on the comm side. For us to be able to share that kind of story. So my first gut reaction was going to be the pilot whale stranding because I felt like I was there. But it's really just the power of technology and audio recording, getting, you know, quotes from the team that while they're rescuing these animals, pilot whales
are... We were on the phone a lot that day together.
Yeah, pilot whales are no joke. I mean, that's 5 whales that stranded at one time and the whole region was watching. The media wanted to be there all day. It was a long endeavor waiting for the tide. You can't just put whales in a vehicle. So the team had
to stay
out there and wait and hope for the best. I felt like we were there together, but we weren't.
Yeah, that was a tough one. We've had a couple pilot whale strandings this year, and that's actually a species that strands like in Australia and New Zealand and Florida. It's one of the species that they will just show up randomly, and in Europe, you just never know when it's going to happen, and it happens like at any time of the year. And it can be in pretty high numbers sometimes, and they're just big animals. They're anywhere from like 800 pounds to 2,000 pounds, and they're not easy to move, and it's just they're nightmare strandings. Basically, they're really tough to deal with, and they take a village. That you need like everybody, and you need all sorts of equipment and resources. You need boats, you need access to different places. You need all your town agencies' support and multiple different agencies that we basically call in help from everyone we can get to do that work. In that particular one, it actually the first report came in the evening. We went out. It was low tide, though. There was nothing we could do. We basically went out, provided some supportive care. We gave the animals fluids. We ran some bloods. We tagged them so that if they showed back up the next day, we at least knew they were the same animals. And we put a satellite tag on a couple of them so that we could track them and know where they were immediately. They did not move, though, because they were high and dry. And the next day, the tides were not in our favor. So they were still, we couldn't do anything first thing in the morning. We had to wait till basically the end of the day before we could move them. Because it gave us some time for some planning. But it basically took everything we had, boats, equipment, people, to try to move them just a little bit down the beach and into the water. And at the very end of the day where our highest tide was, we got them all out. We got one in a pontoon, which is a system, designed by colleagues of ours in Europe and working with folks in New Zealand and to devise a system. And we had them all out. We thought we had them swimming off into the sunset. We thought, wonderful day. We made it work. Unfortunately, right at sunset, four of them turned around and beelined them way back in and stranded themselves into an even worse spot, farther into the mud, where we couldn't get to right at dark. One was still farther off. And so we were kind of put our head down a little bit and tried not to, you know, be as devastated as we felt after, you know, all the effort that went into it, both like physical and emotional. And they made a plan for the next day. And most of them did strand the next day. We unfortunately had we had terrible tides and terrible winds the next day, storm come in. We ended up unfortunately euthanizing four of them. We didn't relocate the last one that had satellite tagged. But the amazing part of that story is that fifth animal we did not think was going to survive because it had stranded over and over again. It was a female and we had a satellite tag on her. She ended up heading a couple days later. We kept watching her close to shore and we kept thinking she was going to strand and we were going to have to satellite tag her because we just thought there was no way she could survive after all of that trauma. She headed offshore and she went hundreds of miles offshore. Her satellite tag transmitted for months. So we do think she survived. So she basically surprised all of us and kind of changed our minds about a lot of things and kind of made us rethink some of the way we'll respond to future events. So yeah, so there's that. So there's a lot of ups and downs in stranding work. So there's long days, there's, you know, hard things, but then there's some really rewarding things at the end.
Yeah, I could see that, you know, your efforts over the course of that much time and then it just to be worse off, you know, the following day can be so devastating. I couldn't imagine, you know, the amount of resources having to be pulled together to make something like that happen and to go in your favor. Cause essentially you want each of these whales to just swim off into the deep and be good and like not traumatized and, you know, go feed and reproduce. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think, you know, these types of experiences, you're not going to have a solid, you know, 100%. This is working out in our favor every single time. And I don't think that's what a lot of people understand when it comes to strandings or any rescue for any animal at that matter, which brings me to my next question. You know, what would you recommend for any animal for people to respond when they see a stranded animal? Like, because we don't want to see people trying to pull a dolphin by the tail back into the water. What is the best plan
TikTok
of action?
Heroes.
Yeah, no TikTok heroes. Don't surf a whale shark by the face, you know, like. What are some of your tips and tricks there to react quickly and properly?
No, it's a great question, and thank you for asking. So the absolute best thing to do is to keep back a safe distance, both for yourself and for the animal, because your presence can really stress that animal out and can actually make a big impact for that animal. Also, I think a lot of things. I think people see these charismatic animals and forget that they are wild animals and they can actually be dangerous as well. We get nervous around them. Those pilot whales can be, they're one of the most dangerous animals to work around. And I think that part with these charismatic marine animals, people completely forget about that part. It can be very dangerous. For us, if you look on our website, we, and it's ifaw.org/stranding, strandings. Both of them get you there, strandings. And I'm sure we hopefully share that. We have all of our information on how to report directly to our hotline. We also have links for how to report to the National Stranding Network, so you can report stranded marine mammals to anywhere in the U.S. And there is also, I believe, a link to the Global Stranding Network, so you can look for stranding networks anywhere internationally as well. So you can find those local resources. Also, when in a pinch, you can usually call local police departments or local natural resources departments. They usually will know who to call. Call local authorities. They will know who to report to. They'll be connected. Most stranding networks work with local law enforcement and police departments, so they'll also know who to report those to. So when you're in a pinch and you don't know who to report to, that would be the next person. And also, if there's a scene that isn't controlled, if people are doing things that they're not supposed to, that's, you'd want to, you know, reach out to them anyways. They can help kind of control that scene and help with that as well. So those are my recommendations. You can help keep back things like goals. So that is an issue we run into. That is a way you can be helpful. We do have, when dolphins or whales strand, unfortunately, one of the things that can happen to them is goals can start to peck at them while they're still alive. It's kind of a unfortunate wild sort of thing that can happen. So you can help keep, you know, scare off goals from a distance, things like that. You can provide valuable information to responders from a distance. You can take a photo from a distance. You can provide that valuable information that helps us to get there faster, get there with what we need, so we can provide that animal with the best care necessary and get and do what we do best.
Mm-hmm. So essentially, call the experts and respect the animal.
Exactly. Yeah. And in cases with seals, it's a little different. A lot of seals don't actually need help. I think people care and they want to help. This is what we dealt with this weekend with Memorial Day weekend. It was a mixing of bad situations where you have young seals that have just been weaned from their moms, meaning that their moms, they only stay with their moms for about a month or 5 to 6 weeks. It's not very long, and they're kind of kicked to the curb and they're on their own. And they're here on the Cape and they're resting on the beach and trying to kind of find a quiet spot to rest. They picked a poor location because the Cape is not that. And then you have people trying to enjoy their time on the beach. And those two things don't always mix together well for young seals. And so a lot of times we're just doing a lot of outreach and education with people, just leave the seals alone, let them be. A lot of times there isn't necessarily anything wrong with them. So it's just a matter of figuring out, is there something wrong with those animals? A lot of times it's just a matter of just letting them be respectful wildlife viewer, keep a distance, take photos and videos from a safe distance back, keep dogs back, keep them leashed, follow your local laws and regulations on dogs and things like that. So be a respectful wildlife viewer, do your part.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've seen some, or probably had a lot of phone calls over this past weekend, which I like to call the drunkest weekend in America.
Yes. Yes. We do field a lot of calls on our hotline and we do a lot of outreach and education, which we love to do. It's a big part of the work that we do. We like to share that with people. Cause it's another surprising thing. You know, we know with dolphins, it's not like, in Florida where people often see bottlenose dolphins off Florida, the coast of Florida, swimming close to shore. While we are a stranding hotspot, these are not coastal species that are swimming close to shore here. They're offshore species that come in and strand or are feeding more offshore that end up stranding here close to shore. So people are very surprised to find out that we have dolphins that strand here on shore. So when you have a dolphin that's swimming close to shore here, it's usually not a normal thing or there is something unusual or something wrong. But with seals, we do have resident seal populations. We have harbor seals and we have gray seals that live here year round, but they're oftentimes in kind of these specific haul out or areas that we call haul outs, where you have big groups of seals that are all together in one area. And people are used to seeing seals in those areas. But when they see younger seals in one particular area. You'll be surprised at how many people who've even lived here on the Cape for, you know, 30 or 40 years are still surprised to see a seal on a particular beach or near where they live, that they've lived for 30 years and they're still surprised. So we end up doing, you know, quite a bit of outreach with people that it's normal to see some of these younger animals by themselves on the beach, and just give them their space, let them be. A lot of times people are well-meaning. They want to help. They see a young looking seal. These seals have these cute eyes. They look up at you. They look really small. They look helpless. Most of the time people are very well-meaning and they want to help, be helpful. Like with the dolphins, as you know, Stacy mentioned before, you know, wanting to put them back in the water. People do generally most of the time, not 100% of the time, but most of the time they do generally care, but are just not making the right decision or aren't well informed about what to do. And so we're happy to share that information. And we have some programs we put out. We made a really cute sign, with a really cute little, seal pup on it. It says, be kind, keep distance in mind. So we're trying to, encourage people to give these seals the space. This is their home too. So this is where they live, let them be and give them their space. So it doesn't then become a stranded seal. So a lot of times these seals are fine and they're okay. But if we keep harassing them or if a dog bites them or if they get overly stressed, then they do become a stranded animal. And then we do have to intervene. And while rehabbing a seal is an option, it's not always, we don't always have space for one. There's very limited rehab space here in the Northeast for seals. And two, it's not the end all be all, you know, solution for everything when it's very limited. And two, you know, if a seal is perfectly healthy, you don't want to pick it up and cause it undue stress if you can help it. It's a wild animal. It should stay in the wild. There are stresses that go along with putting a seal and risks that go into putting a seal into rehab. So you want to use it as a resort when it is needed and not if it is not needed.
Yeah, I don't think people understand how much stress they can put on an animal, you know, just by common interactions that we would see as comforting, you know, they see as stressful.
Yes, I think it's that factor of they're charismatic and they're very cute. Yes, I know. And then people forget that they're still wildlife, so still a wild animal.
The best is to just observe, you know, and just mm-hmm. kind of see. Like, obviously, that animal will tell you or it will look like something is wrong, or you can clearly see that something is wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes they just want to get their tan on the beach. I totally get it.
Exactly. They do sometimes just want to rest. I don't know about tan, but they but they do want to get the rest. Yes. it's a little hard. But they are often just trying to rest. A lot of times we have these are young seals. And like I said, their moms do not spend a lot of time with them and they just let them, they're off on their own. And so they're trying to figure life out. So, they sometimes just need some rest. So they really just need some time. And if we can give that to them, then a lot of times they'll be okay.
There's your next, Pixar film, Stacy. Seals with mommy issues. I didn't know that they were abandoned so young.
Yeah, some of the seal species, it's like a couple of weeks. Harbor seals actually have it good. They get the longest amount of time, but some of the species it's like a week or two. So good luck to you. So yeah.
Wow. So could you say that, you know, with the four species that you've focus on, which species has impacted your lives mostly in the course of your career?
Yeah, and that question would be to both of you guys.
Well, for me, that's really easy. For me, that's really gray seals because they are highly impacted by entanglements. So they by human impacts. So for me, that's really forefront in my mind all the time, and more so today than most days, because this weekend I spent most of my day Saturday hiking out on Monomoy Island, which is I call it the stuff that hangs off the elbow of the Cape. I guess it's a 8-mile spit of it's an island that's south of Chatham. It's Monomoy Island, and we had a report of an young entangled gray seal out there this weekend with a significant amount of gear around its neck, and also what looked to be appear to be a shark bite wound as well, which it's hard to say for sure, but you know, what often happens is if they have these entanglements, that does debilitate them and then puts them at risk for things. So there's a good chance that it could have been entangled. And then because it was debilitated due to the entanglement, it could have then gotten the shark bite. So we hiked, we got a boat ride out with our partners at Fish and Wildlife Service at the refuge there. And then we hiked out there with all of our gear. And we'd been monitoring the animal since the previous day, and it looked like it might have declined a little bit. So we wanted to get out there as soon as we can. And we spent, it's not an easy place to get to, and it's not an easy place to get across. And so we hiked a lot of our gear out with a cart that broke. So we ended up carrying a lot of our gear. And knowing that we
the reality of working in conservation.
Reality of working in conservation. You know, got ourselves out there. And of course the seal moved a little bit farther down the beach and was close to the water. So we got out there thinking we might not have any chance of even catching the seal. Cause while they, move awkwardly on land, they can move fast, much faster than we can sometimes. So we got out there knowing that the seal is probably going to get back in the water before we could catch it. And it moved farther down. So we're going to have a little bit farther to get out there, but we were there, we were going to try, cause that was, you know, basically the seal's only chance if we can't get that entangling line, off around its neck. Cause this is a just recently weaned animal, was probably born this year, sometime in December or January. It was just going to grow into that entanglement, and it was just going to get worse and worse, and that animal was probably going to die. So we knew that this was basically our shot to save this animal. So we hiked our gear out. We got down there. We were a bit spent before we even got down there. And we saw it, and we knew we had one shot at getting this animal. And so we got loaded up because we knew this animal could see us coming. So we knew we were going to have to be, you know, as stealthy as we could, but we were basically going to have to run really fast and try to catch this animal before it got back into the water. And we made a plan, and we got geared up and ready. And we also realized that, sorry, Stacey, plug your ears, but our GoPro was not working. And so we were not going to be able to capture it on camera. The problems of not being able to bring your comms people out with you. But you know, it's the reality of what things happen. And we had a small team with us. So that was about all we could do. We had to have everybody with nets and crowd boards to make sure we could capture the animal. So, but we tried. Had our plan, we executed it, and to I think all of our shocks, it was like textbook, and the seal hesitated for a second, it looked at us, and we caught her, and we were able to capture her, and we got her in the kennel, and she looked pretty rough. So she was bleeding pretty profusely from the shark bite, and it looks like she had a fracture to one of the bones in her rear flipper from that shark bite as well. And so then we had to get her back because we did not want to just disentangle her and release her like we would in many other cases, because she did have some pretty severe injuries. So we opted to bring her back, and we had one rehab spot at Mystic with our partners at Mystic Aquarium. And so we then had the fun trek of getting her back, and we basically had to carry the kennel back a good portion of the way. So she weighed about 40, 50 pounds. The kennel weighed about 40 pounds. Luckily, there was another cart from Fish and Wildlife Service stashed about halfway across. We rigged it up on that, and it worked, thank goodness, because I don't know that we would have made it the rest of the way. We were so tired. We just kept rotating in. The Fish and Wildlife crew had a couple of their staff that were doing some bird work out there that were kind enough to come over and help us get the seal off the island. So we would go about 100, 200 feet, and we would stop, we'd rotate people, and we would just keep walking. The efforts that go into, you know, saving one animal sometimes. We were darned if we were not going to get off that island without that seal. So we did, and we got her off the seal. We brought her back, gave her some treatments, and then the next morning sent her off to Mystic Aquarium, where I've heard she's doing much better with some treatment and some care. And so we're very hopeful that she'll do well.
Shout out to Mystic Aquarium. Yeah. That's amazing.
So a lot of
some determination too.
A lot of effort went into that rescue. I'm not as young as I used to be. So I felt that the next day. I think a few of us did. So but yeah, so boat ride, a truck ride, and a long hike across Matamoy Island. And but we were determined. So yeah.
So it's awesome. Gray whales. It's gray whales for Misty. What about Stacy?
Yeah, I'm gonna have to stick with the marine theme a bit, because we've had such a large focus right now on the North Atlantic right whale, and I kind of remember we had kind of a university endeavor a year or two ago where we kind of were looking for taglines and ideas for this whale, and we came up with the "Don't Fail Our Whale" kind of a slogan, because the North Atlantic right whale really is our whale to lose or to save on the east coast of the U.S. It travels from Georgia or Florida area all the way up to the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Canada, where it's just about to head at this moment. And as Misty mentioned, there are fewer than 350 left. Only about 70 of those are reproductive females. And for me, that's also a good climate subject, because those females are traveling longer, harder distances. They're navigating our shipping lanes and noises and so forth. And they're giving birth a lot less. So where we used to see them giving birth every 2 or 3 years, they're now giving birth every 6 or 7 years. And for us, it's kind of a really holistic story to follow. You know, Misty's talking about one individual animal, and we can follow that to a whole population in the case of a North Atlantic right whale. And it merges us with the kind of the rescue side of our work and the conservation side of our work. And really, what does it take when Misty's team gets called to rescue one of those animals, or to help it in some way? And then we're also at the same time looking at the whole population and the impact of policy when it comes to shipping speeds and shipping lanes, or climate subjects, kind of gives it that whole story. And for me, particularly this year, we've had our research vessel, we have a purpose-built research vessel still in the water right now in the Gulf of Maine, following the migratory route of the North Atlantic right whale. I've been fortunate to be able to get on the boat a couple of times. Misty's probably been out in another boat alongside too. It's a really great way to take a big subject and to put it, you know, right in, for me, for putting it in front of the camera, or the stories that we can tell from actually being out there on a vessel with a research team, understanding the behaviors of this species so that we can help impact change. And so that's really just what is most kind of our last, the boat has been traveling since January. So it's a really special story for us to be following along. And again, pulling the rescue team or the conservation team into each and every step of that journey, really merging our teams together to be able to tell that and to bring it to the forefront for a regular person. It's the right whale is called the right whale because it was the right whale to kill back in the day when commercial whaling was very prominent in our region. But it is now it's kind of the right whale to save for us. It's the kind of dying for the wrong reasons. And we want to be able to kind of take that, you know, and look forward with hope and optimism that we can make a difference.
Yeah, that's amazing. I think both excellent choices for favorite animals to work with, or most impactful to work with.
I thought I was isolated to seals, but that worked out great because now we balanced them both. So that worked out lovely. So I second Stacey. It's hard to choose. So,
I was surprised, yeah, Missy, that you didn't pick the North Atlantic right well, but I love that you got to tell this story from this incredible, this entanglement story, just like the photos. We definitely have a small text chain when something happens. And seeing the photos, you know, knowing that the team was going out to save this seal, it looked pretty bad. So it's a really incredible story to be able to say now that seal is rehabilitating and will be fine, hopefully, because of that quick and tactful work, kind of sneaky workout on the beach.
Yeah, on Memorial Day weekend of all things.
Yeah, well, we're on one of the only beaches where people weren't, so so it was good. We're on a remote island where no one else was, but yeah, no, in you know, gray seals are in the opposite spectrum of right whales in the sense that, you know, because they are not endangered, the focus is not put on them. So, and a lot of species are like that. So minke whales, humpback whales, there's a lot of species that get impacted by the same things. They get impacted by a vessel strikes, they get impacted by entanglements, but they're not, the focus and a lot of resources do not get put on them because they're not endangered. But we also have concerns about them because we know they still get, we see the impacts of them every day, of them getting killed still. And also there's the, there's just the population concerns about animals getting killed, but there's also the human welfare or the animal welfare aspects of it. So these entanglements, as I mentioned, who knows how long this animal had this gear around its neck, but we know if we didn't get it off there, it would have stayed until that animal died. And, I used to do this activity with kids for outreach where I'd have them put a rubber band around their thumb and around their pinky finger around the back of their hand and have asked them to get it off there without trying to use their other hand and see if they can. Most of the time they can't. Some kids that were resourceful and they could do it. But talk to them about what it would be like if that stayed on their hand for a day or for a week or what about a month and how that would impact them and what would start to happen. And just really start to feel like what that would feel like if it started to cut into your hand and it would start to get infected and how that would affect you for eating and how that would affect you for your day-to-day life. And just to start to get the impacts of how that would for the animals, how that must feel and how that the pain must feel. I can't even imagine. And especially when it's around your neck. And we see this when we do the necropsies on these animals or when we disentangle these animals and we see the wounds, they're really significant. From a distance, they don't look so bad. But when you take the gear off and you look at them, it's really bad. Mm-hmm. These are awful wounds. And nobody intends to do these. It's not trying to make a bad guy out of anybody. This is never anybody's intention to cause this kind of harm to an animal. This is all, it's food that feeds our country. It feeds people. We all partake in the food that it feeds. It sustains us. But it does mean that we need to all work together with industry and with the government and with all parties invested to try to figure out how to prevent this from happening so that this doesn't happen. And try to come up with solutions because we can try to do these efforts that we did this weekend to disentangle a seal, but this is not a solution. Having a team hike across Monomoy to get a seal and put it in rehab is not the solution to this problem. This is not the way to go. It was really difficult to do. And we were lucky we got that seal. We're lucky we got that report. We're lucky that seal stayed where it was. But that is not a solution to the problem. So, things like solutions that IFAW is working on with, on-demand gear, but that doesn't as much solve the problem. This is monofilament, netting, which can be used for this, but doesn't solve the netting issue. But for other things with right whale, with fixed gear, like on-demand gear, was known more as ropeless gear, does help for different types of fishing gear and with a lot of entanglements that right whales suffer in, and also can impact gray seals as well for other types of entanglements. And those help all whales or all marine species and turtles and things like that as well. Looking at solutions like that, and that IFAW has been working really hard to push forward innovations like that are, you know, what we need to do is more things like that so we can have these across the board solutions that help prevent these things from happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. More preventative measures.
Exactly.
Yeah, I actually want to dive into something that I think you kind of hit on just a little bit, and then maybe course corrected a little. But there's a human impact element to this. And I think this is one that's often overlooked, and it's probably not going to be what you expect. But the internal team human impact, it seems like there are a lot of fairly, I would say, sad experiences might be the best way to put it. Borderline negative. You're dealing with animals that are endangered. It's very stressful. You know, on all of you guys that work as a part of your organization. One of the things that I feel like gets incredibly overlooked is how important those little wins are, for you guys personally. You know, to be able to go through that entire, you know, hike, to go through that entire process of the call for an entangled animal, to going through that adventure, to facing some adversity with, the cart falling apart, to not knowing whether you were going to capture the animal, going through all of that, you know, and having, a win at the end of the day with the animal that is recovering, that seems to me like it makes all of the other, you know, fairly painful experiences that you may have going through necropsy, seeing, you know, mass strandings, it makes all of that worth it. So can you talk about, you know, how those experiences help you get through the difficult times and make you even want to continue this?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the best news we heard was our team that on Sunday morning that met early to do treatments on the seal before getting it, getting her packed up and ready to get transported to Mystic Aquarium. The seal was perky and the fluids and the treatment from the day before had worked, and the rest had helped. And the seal was alert and responsive and had a lot more energy. And that was the best news I could have heard, because the seal, you know, had a very stressful day and was not as alert the day before. And that makes us, you know, obviously, you know, concerned, but also to be expected given everything the animal had been through. And so that was the best news we could have asked for. We want, these are wild seals. They should have a lot of energy. They should be, be very responsive and alert. And that was what we had seen. That was the best news we had heard. We all were very excited to see that and to hear that. And that helps a lot. And I think every time we release a dolphin, as Stacey mentioned the last time, we had been out in the field together and you see five dolphins swim off, and to see our volunteers and to see the public when they see that. And a lot of times the public will clap and cheer when we release those dolphins. And it's so wonderful to see that. And it never gets old. that feeling never gets old. That's what we're all here for. That's what we want to see happen. That's why we do this every day. Those wins are very helpful, and that helps get through those tough times. Cause yeah, being at those necropsies and seeing those injuries from human impacts, are hard. And that's what I think helps, but that also helps, I think, drive us. We know that, you know, a lot of times, a lot of the species we work with are not necessarily endangered. They're not, common dolphins that are most frequent to, mass strand or Atlantic whiteside dolphins, and are not necessarily endangered, but we know the amount of, impacts and the amount of threats that, animals face in the ocean. So they may not be, obvious to on an animal that we might necropsy. There's a lot of things that are very obvious that we might see on necropsy. So like a vessel strike or an entanglement or plastics in the stomach. These are things that are very obvious. But there's a lot of things that are very hard to know the impacts that things are impacts that we're as humans are having on a species. So things like climate change is really hard to really measure the impacts that we have. So even things like contaminants or biotoxins, and even microplastics, things like that, we are still trying to figure out how do we measure those impacts that we're having on these species. Antibiotic resistance, things like that. Those are really difficult to measure the impacts over time. So we know we're having impact. Ocean noise is another big one that we know has a huge impact on these species. It has to. We've put so much noise into the oceans. These animals, that's how they navigate through the water, through the oceans. So we know that they have that impact, or we know we're having those impacts, but we can't necessarily measure it. So I think that's a lot, at least that's what drives me. I know that drives a lot of our team to keep doing this work, and making sure that we are rescuing as many animals as we can, and also gathering that data, gathering that baseline data, doing this work with science-based and making sure that we can kind of put that picture together so that we're monitoring health of these populations and better understanding what's going on with these animals.
I will add too, and then when I think IFA was the first job I ever applied to when I was 21. And I thought at the time I couldn't work in a career like this because of the horrific images and stories and not wanting that negativity every day. And the same can be said for following social media channels, and you don't want that like sad Sarah McLachlan every couple of hours in your inbox or your feed. No offense to any organization that works with Sarah McLachlan, but you know, the sadness and the scare tactics that may have been present like 20, 30 years ago, I feel like has changed, at least for IFA. I think a lot of our, as I mentioned, I started on our social media side, and it's as much optimism and hope that we can convey, because you're not going to, you know, obviously we're looking for donations or supporters or signing a petition. You're not going to take that action if you don't think you can make a difference. So if we're just going to share tragic, sad, gory stories all the time, and you just feel despair and don't feel like you can save the species, then you're not going to sign the petition, or you're not going to call your local politician, or you're not going to make a donation. But if we can inspire hope and change and show that, you know, we do believe we can save the species, and give maybe some tangible, small little ways that we can all do so or work together, then I think that's just today's world, I hope, or it is for us as an organization. That's why the TikTok is so fun, because it's very humorous and not at all taking itself seriously.
Yeah, that's literally the baseline of what we're doing with this show. You know, it's why it's got the name it has. It's why our organization kind of has the pillars that it has as an entire whole, is to make sure that, you know, while we need to highlight the sad and we need to acknowledge that it's there, that, you know, we need to more highlight the fixes and enjoy the improvements that are being made and enjoy those wins and provide a bit of humor, provide a bit of that, you know, wild, fun story, so it attracts more people. Because I definitely think, you know, Stacey, like you hit on those scare tactics from years ago. I don't know what the hell anyone was thinking making those. That's not my cup of tea. You know, I was always, you know, taught you catch more bees with honey. And I think positive, funny, impactful content is what attracts, you know, the next generation, the generation that's existing, for, you know, donations and support. And it's important to enjoy those things.
Yeah. We all do this because we think we can make a difference. We're not doing it because we think it's all gloom and doom. We do it because we believe they're, you know, we're making a difference, and we still have hope that there's something that can be done. And yes, it's those positive moments that keep us going. But also I think it's that we know we're making a difference, and it's important, keeps us going and keeps us driving. But I think also seeing this kind of sadder side also keeps driving us too, and knowing that that's important. I think it's all parts of those. And you know, it's all of that together that keeps us going every day, keeps us willing to jump back into the mud or get gooed up in whale goo. And you know, all the weird things that we do every day, or hauling gear, or, you know, all the kind of very random, very, the very, very, unexpected things that we do every day that is not part of most people's day-to-day lives. So that is part of our day-to-day lives.
I think that's a good segue. You mentioned whale goo and unexpected things. could you dive into maybe a story that, you know, could be more or less surprising to the audience out there? When it comes to anything, strandings or rescues or rehabilitation, any wild stories that you can think of?
Oh, goodness. I'm sure I have a few. I will admit,
this is where the fun begins.
There was, it's more heartwarming than than not, but it was a few years back. It was actually one of our first dolphins that we released as a single stranded dolphin, which was something we didn't used to do. But we have since changed, we have started satellite tagging single stranded dolphins and proved that they can actually survive. They can meet up with other dolphins. With groups of dolphins, and as long as they meet our health assessments, like our master stranded dolphins do, we have kind of changed the basically
the protocol. It used to be acceptable to euthanize if it was a single stranded animal.
It was better, it wouldn't survive. Yeah, it was actually kind of the standard protocol. If an animal was by itself, it was believed there was something wrong with it. And we, through necropsy work, have kind of showed that that wasn't the case. And we worked with NOAA to kind of change that around. But kind of in the early days, when we were trying to kind of figure that out, we had this one single-stranded animal, and she was back in the mud. And my coworker and I rode out in a small dinghy and to get to this dolphin. And the holders for the oars broke. And so we were not very well rowing in a dinghy out in the mud. And the animal was like going down in the mud and getting stuck. And we were like panicking. Like I was like literally having a panic attack that this dolphin was going to die in front of us.
Sounds like a chaotic scene.
It was chaotic.
There's mud there going people, anywhere. There's a busted there's, dinghy. Someone's hyperventilating yeah. in the yeah. dinghy.
It was a little stressful, and we were basically, you know, people were watching us from above, I'm sure videotaping us, which was stressing me out. And we just didn't like have a lot of options. It was just a really inaccessible area. We couldn't really get out there much. So we had a dolphin stretcher with us and just the two of us. And we get out to this dolphin and we get there and we're trying to stretcher it from the side, and the dolphin's thrashing and covering us in mud. And she was stressed out. We were stressed out, and we don't normally, like, he was one of like the staff members on our team, and both of us don't usually use, you know, colored language or foul language, and we both were using not so good language, and
we don't use foul language on the show.
Luckily no one was around us, so it was good. No one heard us. And we were just getting really like, we're running out of options here, and we couldn't get her stretchered, and we were just, you know, kind of running out of options. And it was like, let's put the dolphin in the dinghy. I'm like, we're not putting the dolphin in the dinghy. We can't put the dolphin in the dinghy. And so we were just trying to figure things out. And we, you know, took a deep breath, kind of found a calm, and we managed to get... He held on to the dolphin. I found a nearby line that was kind of holding the floating docks in. And I pulled us, well, he held onto the dolphin on the side, and I pulled us to the floating docks. And we brought some people in to help us, and we were able to stretcher her and get her out. And we were able to tag and release her. But as we were meeting all of our colleagues, this had gone on for quite some time. Apparently what I didn't know is that mud had dried all over. I was covered in head to toe in mud, and mud had like smeared across my face and had dried, and people had tried to wipe it off my face, but it wasn't coming off my face. And so I was talking to like police officers, I was talking to Department of Natural Resources, and some of our staff had come up, and our now vet had come up to me, and she just started laughing. She's like, I cannot take you seriously right now. You have mud literally just like smeared all across your face. I've been talking to people for, you know, a good couple hours with mud just like smeared all across my face. I had no idea. But we got this animal out and were able to release her. And, you know, after, you know, a little bit of, you know, a lot of mud and, you know, a bit of struggle, but it was, you know, a lot of determination. So that comes down to a lot of teamwork on our team, a lot of people that do amazing things, a lot of support. And as I mentioned, you know, before, it takes a village to do that, the work that we do. We don't do anything in a bubble. We have an incredible team that we work with, and a lot of incredible people. So we talk a lot about, like, you know, we do this for the animals, but we do this for the animals. We love what we do. We do everything for the animals, but really a lot of this is about the people that we work with. We have a lot of people who are willing to do, you know, be really determined and stick to it.
Get muddied up.
So it's good for the skin sometimes.
That was the closer we needed.
And I think a great example of, you know, the teamwork that you guys have is, you know, just represented right here between yourself, Misty, and you, Stacy. I mean, you can see the collaborative effort just back and forth, even within this show. So it's amazing to see the teamwork that goes into an organization like this that has such an impactful job, essentially.
Yeah, I'm happy we could be your first two-member team to come join and have this discussion.
Yeah.
It really does feel like a nice discussion with friends.
And that's how it should be. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you know, I think major mainstream media has gotten away from connecting and gotten away from digestible content and being able just to have a conversation, because these conversations with friends essentially is what changes, you know, the world that we live in. It impacts friendships, and then it impacts communities, and then it impacts at a larger scale, so on all the way up to global. So it's important to have these conversations and just feel like you're kind of shooting the, and I'll bleep myself out for foul language purposes, shooting it with friends. So I'm glad you guys feel that way.
Yeah, no, we're very lucky. As I mentioned, I said 10 staff, but it's really more than that. We have a lot of, you know, techs that work with us, and a lot of interns that work with us. And we have a lot of our additional staff, like Stacy's, that Stacy wasn't even in that 10 because she works in a different department. And we just, there's so much crossover between different people that we work with. And then we work with our network partner agencies at other training agencies. And we work with the towns on a regular basis to do the work that we do. It's just nothing we do is easy. So, you know, from if it's moving a whale off the beach or, you know, Stacy had mentioned a seal that got into a bad situation. It's just nothing. We also recently had a seal in a cranberry bog. Seals don't belong in cranberry bogs. And we had a seal that was...
Wait, like from the commercials where the dudes are just standing in there and the waiters and they're like stomping on the cranberries?
Yes.
How did that happen? Yes.
It came up a culvert and landed in a cranberry bog and did not want to leave. And this was actually a seal that...
I mean, I wouldn't either.
We had already captured the seal and released the seal. It was between a train track and a road about 2 weeks prior. It just kept picking. It also gone under a culvert, under a rolled road. It just kept picking. This is just terrible places to land. This was a gray seal again. And that took about 15 people and on our team to capture this one seal safely and relocate it. So just everything we do just requires, you know, just a lot of collaboration, a lot of teamwork, a lot of moving parts, a lot of inner coordination, things like that. So we're very lucky to work with a lot of really incredible people and with a lot of skills and a lot of experience and background. So very lucky. Our village that does our stranding work. So.
Well, that's incredible. It does take a village. There's one segment I didn't believe we dove into very far. Let's pass Stacy the mic. And metaphorically speaking, you have your own mic. Let's pass Stacy the mic. And Stacy, could you kind of dive into, you know, your role with communications? I know this is something that we wanted to touch base on before we started to wrap the show. Let's just dive into a little bit about how you connect with, you know, the collaborations that you work with and the other organizations that IFAL is in tune with. Just kind of give us the full background on that, the full scope, if you can.
No, but it's 10 o'clock at night. All right.
Well, thank you for being so committed at 10 o'clock at night. We appreciate it.
True.
No problem. I'm trying to get closer and closer.
Might be time to come home.
I'm trying to get closer and closer to the light because the window's pitch black outside. All right.
And you can keep it short. It could be bullet points. You don't have to.
Cool. Well, we have chatted about social media and how that's one of the best ways for us to get our message out. Obviously, we're telling stories, big stories for entire species or continents to the average audience, and trying to kind of pique pique someone's interest in a moment, a blip, a scroll of their thumb. So we definitely also call on influencers. That's changed over the years. It used to be more traditional celebrities. Now it's certainly Instagram or TikTok folks. It's also still celebrities. There are celebrities doing incredible things behind the scenes that we don't necessarily know about. Someone like Alicia Silverstone, who we've known as vegan and has a prominent The Kind Life business, but she's not necessarily out there as an active, you know, like screaming from her own platform voice. She's speaking up for other subjects. We have some celebrities that are like that, who are really jumping in to speak for subjects, whether it's elephants or big cats. We have incredible troubles with big cats in our backyards, like tigers in American backyards. So we have folks who will join us on those kinds of missions, including even showing up on Capitol Hill and speaking with us. But then there's also corporate partnerships. So just before hopping on the phone with you, I was chatting with Munchkin, which is an incredible, I would love to call them kind of a local business, but an international business out of Los Angeles that is the number one manufacturer of sippy cups in the world, and so many other things for toddlers and babies and their parents. They are incredibly passionate about animals. They've had a long time amount of work for orcas and inspired in different ways to support orcas. They're currently supporting us on elephant work in Africa. We have other brands that may be are less a consumer product, but something like platforms that can create videos that are creatives in their own right and that can donate their time or their skills to us and to showcasing our messaging. When it comes coming up very quickly is another massive shipping company that is willing to change its shipping lanes and shipping speeds in different parts of the world. So this one is coming up in the Mediterranean. But we these companies are joining us in a different way. And, you know, they can write their own press releases about it and they can say these wonderful things, but it's not greenwashing. They're actually changing shipping lanes, which is costly, to save certain species of whales that really call on them. To some of this North Atlantic right whale work, we're working directly with fishermen, with lobstermen, to help make some of the changes and innovations to fishing gear. So there's a lot of that kind of work that happens behind the scenes that we're really proud of. I think IFA is unfortunately quite humble in some of our own communication. So it's really fun when we get others speaking for us and joining us in this mission. So we call in those different elements beyond the average social media push. Hope that's helpful.
Definitely. Yeah, that's a great dive into that. Thank you for explaining that. That's incredible. I'm intrigued about, you know, this change in shipping lanes. That's a massive shift for a company to prove that, you know, they're rolling their sleeves up and they mean well for right whales or for a whale species in general. That's incredible.
Yeah, we're really proud of that work. It's taken us from throughout the Mediterranean and the North Sea and also to Sri Lanka. So some of those, I think we're expecting more and more announcements. MSC is the largest shipping company in the world, and they've already made some big, bold announcements with alongside IFA. So once somebody does it, it really becomes something everyone has to do. So, and, you know, just to look at what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Kind of sets that precedent for new waves.
Well, I think that's a good place to start the wrap up of our show. Thank you, Misty. Thank you, Stacy. Now is definitely the time where we can kind of push the shout outs of how to get in contact with you guys, how to get in contact with the organization in general.
I think that probably falls to me by default.
I would say that's a good fit.
So IFA, we've been saying IFA a lot. It's the International Fund for Animal Welfare, IFAW. And our website is IFA.org. And our social channels are generally IFA Global. So IFAW Global. That's TikTok, Instagram. You can find us at IFA on Facebook and LinkedIn, YouTube. There's everywhere you can find us and play along. join us in the stories and kind of follow along with people like Misty and teams that are out doing the work. It's hopefully an inspiring part of your day.
Yeah, I would say so. I would say it inspired our day.
Well, thank you so much for having us on. This was really fun, and we appreciate you sharing the work that we care so much about. So we really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. We want to put you guys on a pedestal and, you know, show a different side to organizations that not many people get to see and really humanize. So right back at you guys. Thank you for taking the time. I know it's not easy, especially for scheduling purposes. We definitely went through the ringer on that. But we appreciate as well. And we're so happy to have you guys as our guests.
Thank you so much.
Thank you both.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of the Wild and Unprotected podcast, brought to you by Wildscape Productions. Follow us on social media at Wildscape Productions. For more information on our documentary series, Shoreline Stories, visit wildscapeproduction.com. Stay tuned for our future episodes, as we have so much more in store for Wild and Unprotected.